Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Everyone, welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio, or Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are talking with Richard Guy Wilson, esteemed architectural historian and educator and ardent connoisseur of art and literature. From Wharton to Jefferson, pillars to diners, we'll get a look into the ever-curious mind of Richard Guy Wilson. And we move from the concrete to the paranormal. We're taking an interesting journey with Dr. Jim Tucker into the unexpected, peculiar reports of children who seem to have lived previous lives. Tucker has published widely in scientific journals on the topic of life after death. We will be very excited to hear more about all of that. And Nancy, my friend, are you there with me?
I am here. Ellen, you almost sound out of breath from all of that. I am here. My goodness. It's jam-packed. I get it.
Yes. Very.
I think from... Yeah. Huh?
Nothing.
I was going to say, I think from the last... From last once we spoke, the election has come and gone, and I'm happy to say where I am not is on the ledge anymore. I am not on the ledge.
Yay.
I'm inside. I'm happy to say.
Yes. I'm so glad. So much hope. I've talked to so many people who've expressed similar things that now they have a little bit more hope, you know, as opposed to the usual that we're accustomed to, feeling pretty tired and fatigued from it all and hopeless. So
yeah, even if the wheel is just spinning around on the computer, that's much better than what it was doing before the 6th.
Yeah.
And what do you think of this slow, you know, it's like 37, might be 36, but I'm just going to say 37 seats that they've captured so far. I think there's still 6 to call. But what do you think of the slow pace versus the, you know, the tsunami effect?
Well, I'm grateful for it. However, in a way, I wished it was happening all at once because of the, you know, the talk about like, well, it wasn't a tsunami or it wasn't a big deal, even though without those seats, it certainly was the most seats picked up in a decade, I believe. And is it 230? It's like 231 to 198 in the House. But anyway, I'll take it anyway, as you might say.
I think it's a little higher than that. But regardless,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, only because they keep trickling
yeah.
in. And I do hear you about, you know, just to have the satisfaction of the instant satisfaction.
Right.
But I'm getting the sense it's still... He's still feeling it. You know, it's like the slow water torture for him. So there is that.
That is great. And, you know, speaking of the instant gratification, I read something on the Democracy Now! Report that we broadcast here on the station. Did you hear about this, that there is an investigation that the New York Times did called it's written right here on this page. Delay, deny, deflect. Okay, so that Facebook used a Republican firm to attack critics and spread disinformation, that they were aware of a Russian misinformation campaign, and then they actually took aggressive measures to combat critics and spread misinformation. Did you hear about that?
I heard the headline, and that I heard what you had said, not the in depth beyond that. Yeah, exactly. It's not all about the grandparents posting pictures during the 2016 election at all. Yeah, I heard.
It's just nefarious, really. It's hard to believe. But moving right along, because I want to get to these guys who are the most important people in this room. There's an event to make you aware about. It's called Vibrate Higher, in honor and memory of Heather Heyer, who was murdered here August 11th or 12th. It's a book drive in memory of her. for adult and juvenile inmates. It will be December 8th at Trinity Episcopal Church. So they say that while we may not be able to free their bodies, those imprisoned, let's attempt to help free their minds. So that seems like a great cause.
Totally. Yes. Yeah, I know. I mean, you guys are, well, we all are. Who kidding? I mean, it's a nationwide problem. I know you're, who would have thought that that could happen? But, you know, there's so many atrocities. I'm not taking away from that event, actually. I'll just shut up. I'm glad you're having that event. Never mind.
Yes. So we have an excellent, excellent show today. Our first guest is Richard Guy Wilson, the preeminent scholar of architecture at the University of Virginia. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and Commonwealth Professor of Architectural History, specializing in the design and art of the 18th to the 21st century, both in America and abroad. He's written, co-written, or contributed to over two dozen books, not only about buildings, but art and literature. A sample of his book topics illustrate the range of knowledge from Newport shingle style, the Prairie School in Iowa, to Edith Wharton's life and home, and a book on the machine age, highlighting American art, and, of course, architecture of Virginia and the University of Virginia. Wilson is, of course, a teacher. Out of admiration for his legacy, an alumnus endowed the Richard Guy Wilson Prize for Excellence in the Study of Buildings, Landscapes, and Places. It's been awarded the past 2 years since its beginning. And I wanted to welcome him back to the show because he was here. We were so lucky to have him, and he decided to come back, which we are thrilled about. Welcome back.
I just want to say it's saying something, because I know the architecture in which you two are sitting is not noteworthy. So it's amazing he came back to suffer through those four walls. Okay, I'm done.
That's true. So welcome back, Richard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I wanted to turn to the prize, which was so cool that someone funded this or endowed this prize to be awarded to UVA students who produce the best scholarly or creative work with historic building, place, or landscape. And this year it went to a project called Turn Park in New Jersey's Meadowlands. And the students called it a response to recent speculations that these meadowlands, very grassy, wet area, might become America's first national park for climate resilience. Can you tell us what you know about this project?
Well, it was a very interesting, it came out of a couple of studios in the landscape program at the university in the architecture school. And what they looked at is that area up there that sometimes we drive through if you're on 95, headed mm-hmm. north there. And, of course, there's been a lot of speculation about developing that. And a lot of us, some of us feel that that's not appropriate for this, that it is so low. And actually, what you do have there is a big area that really should be preserved and turned into a national park. And they did a big study on this, looking at what has happened over what can we figure out for a couple of centuries and so forth, and that are advocating, they're not alone in this, but it's really the very first, not the first, but it's one of the best studies of that area. And that it really needs to be kept as is rather than goofed up.
Mm-hmm. So, Richard, what is so, coming from you, it means more than my question. So what is so important to all of us that architects study space before they do anything, you know, that you put the emphasis on the study of space, people's spaces?
Well, boy, that's a complicated question because, unfortunately, I'm a historian. And so I have to note that the term space, the way we use it today, was not invented until the early 20th century. That while the term space, you can look back in Oxford English Dictionary and so forth and see it there, the way that we're thinking about it today as an actual entity in itself really appears in the early 20th century in architectural and landscape types of discourse and so forth. And what it is really is, I think, is the importance of this, as you said, of studying what was there before, what we're putting there, is that we're developing so fast. There's so many more people that we need so many more buildings to house people. I mean, we have major crises in this country about housing people and so forth. And so where should they be put? Where should these buildings go? And there are some places that are appropriate, and then there are other places that just simply, like the Meadowlands, really shouldn't be put there. That it's a natural preserve. It is, of course, it's got a big drainage issue and all of that. And it just would be very, very difficult to develop it. And especially, of course, who knows what it's going to be like in 20 years, 30 years, but the rise of water levels and so forth, we're facing some issues that we can't really predict and so forth. I mean, what's going to happen to Florida? What's going to happen to Venice?
Right.
You understand? I mean, it's Venice, they've tried to raise up a couple of buildings there on the Plaza San Marco, to raise up the cathedral 4 feet. Well, the rise is going to be 15 feet or something like that. And so what do you do about this sort of thing? So we shouldn't be building in places that that sort of thing is going to happen.
And those kind of forces, you know, how political, well, since you're the historian, has building a space or a building always been political and economic, or is that a more modern
debate? Yes, it's always been economical and political, as you said. Where buildings go and so forth has always been an issue. It just is that I think that we are spreading so vast outside of what used to be cities and areas and so forth, that you just have to pay a lot more attention to what is going on out there and to try to take care of it and not ruin it.
What was the most important advice you've received from a mentor or a teacher?
Always be looking. Always be looking. Don't think that you have a favorite. I mean, I get sometimes always the question. You're probably going to ask me at some point here.
Not anyway. Anymore.
But you know, what's your favorite building? And I always say, hey, it's what I'm studying at that point in time that I have to pay attention to, and that there are great things. Then there are what we might call secondary things, but we have to pay attention to them because the built environment is us. That's where we live, and we have to pay attention to this. And we can admire, as I say, like the cathedral there, San Marco in Venice, but then there's a lot of other things that are part of this, part of the environment, and we have to pay attention to those.
Mm-hmm. So of the spaces that you're in, which cities or which places do you like to go because of what is built there?
Well, I always like to go someplace new. I've never been. But of places, well, I mean, there's so many places that I love to go to. London, Copenhagen, of all places. But at the same time, little towns in this country that you go out and take a look at, whether it is here in Virginia, such as going up to Warrenton and taking a look there, or maybe out in the Middle West, Mason City, Iowa, of all places. Who's ever heard of that? But that has one of the greatest collections of Frank Lloyd Wright and his disciples' buildings anywhere in this country. And there it is, up in the northern western part of Iowa, of all places.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, all right. So, you know, we have a huge number of listeners in Copenhagen, and I would like to know, what do I not know about Copenhagen?
Well, Copenhagen, has a tremendous early architectural heritage of dating from the 14th, the 15th, the 16th century. But then I think what is also very interesting is that Copenhagen has some wonderful modern work. And, of course, there is the Danish furniture that we all, or a lot of us know and so forth, but that really spread over into the architecture and so forth, and that there's some really rather incredible buildings that are there that are worthwhile looking at. So there's the past, but there's also the recent past and what's going on today.
Now, isn't Copenhagen the city where an architect designed a square, a public square, to represent in this particular area. There were a lot of there are a lot of immigrants there,
yes.
And he designed something so that he took the pulse of those people, so to speak, and said, "What is your favorite object from your country?" So from Morocco, they really wanted to see something that reminded them of their public square, and it was a fountain. And another culture, you know, it was something else. And I think that is just the most wonderful kind of thing. You have this square where there's all these different sorts of reminders.
Yes. Well, of course, that's one of the interesting things about both Denmark, but also of Scandinavia, that supposedly the people there are the happiest in the world on these charts that are done.
Yeah.
And I think that what it is that it's much more of an accepting type of a culture that has gone, that's been developed there over the years.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I hear the argument to that as well. They're not as eclectic, or, you know, they're more homogeneous than our country. But yeah. I think that's a case in point that I don't think that would really matter.
No, it's there is a... There's a diversity and so forth. And yes, there's been some problems recently. I think, I'm a little off on this. I think that Norway sort of stepped back from accepting immigrants. But still, overall, I think that you do find a welcoming type of an atmosphere there that is very, very positive. And that the architecture, the built environment, is part of that.
You've mentioned a few times the art in other sentences, and I was just wondering, I know you've curated exhibits, so what kind of art are you drawn to? Does it match your architectural emphasis?
Well, my architectural emphasis is all over the place, so my art's all over the place. I mean, I like, I always read the comics every morning. I have... got to start out hopefully happily, but also, I mean, I like folk art, outsider art, whatever you call that. At the same time, also in my own house, I mean, I have works by some very eminent artists. At the same time, and I don't say that they're not eminent, but also some of the local artists that are here in Charlottesville and so forth. I believe in trying to be diverse in what you see, and so I can go from abstract to very realistic and to cartoons.
I can attest to that. There was a project we were working on, I believe, with your wife, and I had the pleasure of being at your home, and there is, I am not exaggerating, it is floor to ceiling art, and from side to side, every single space is a piece of art, and it's all very different and eclectic, and it is wonderful. You should give tours. Have you ever done that?
Oh, a little bit, yes.
A little bit, yeah. It's worthy of that. I mean, Nancy, you and I should go. If we're invited.
We're going. Getting my ticket. I'll print it out after this is done. I love the eclectic nature of you. What drew you to the architectural history of the 18th to 20th centuries as far as teaching, et cetera?
Well, my beginning in architectural history, let me just back up for half a second. See, I was born in Los Angeles, the home of everything new, and my parents were modern art freaks of the worst order, and I was born in a house designed for them by this very eminent Southern California architect, R.M. Schindler, and is still there in the Silver Lake District. Now, so I grew up with the modern stuff. But then when I finally did discover, after roaming around for many, many years and trying law school and other sorts of things, that I really wanted to be an architectural historian, my interest was initially drawn to late 19th, early 20th century, much more traditional type of architecture, which really wasn't being studied much at that time. And my mom said, "My goodness, that's not what you should be studying at all. You should be looking at the modern stuff." So anyway, I say there's diversity. And just to note that when I came to the University of Virginia, a mentor said to me, "Well, you're going to become the Jefferson expert." And I said, "No way, I'm not going to do anything with him." Well, you're around for a while and you become part of the Jefferson Mafia.
And on that note, we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back with Richard Guy Wilson, and then a little bit later, very soon, Jim Tucker, about life after death. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. I'm Ellen Daniels. I'm with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence. And with us today is Richard Guy Wilson, professor of architectural history at the University of Virginia. I don't really want to talk about Jefferson, but I do want to ask you one thing about that. And then you can talk as much or little about him as you want. But I read that you said this. You said that Jefferson was an architectural nut of the first order. What do you mean by that?
Jefferson, from very early on, and this would be very unusual in the American colonies, became entranced with architecture. He apparently bought his first architectural book while he was still a student at the College of William and Mary. And keep in mind that there were no architecture. The first architectural book published in this country was until 1798, and we're talking about somewhere in the 1760s that he bought a book. And architectural books were very, very expensive, and he bought one then, and we do know that by 1771 he at least had three books, and in time he went on to have more than 40 books in his more than 7,000 title library that he owned. And these books were very, very expensive. And from very early on, he was remodeling, thinking about doing a house up on top of this little hill of Monticello. This is something that was just with him all of his life, wherever he moved. When he was up in New York as Secretary of State, well, when he was in Philadelphia with the Declaration of Independence, New York as the Secretary of State in Washington's administration, often Paris, when he lived over there, he remodels the quarters he's in. He doesn't own them, but he remodels them. Well, what does that say? He is very consumed with where it is that he lives and so forth. And he himself said that, there's a number of different quotes, but anyway, that architecture is my passion and putting up and pulling down my greatest delight.
Mm-hmm. Fake architecture then? No, sure it's not. So Richard, in terms of like current, trends, what do you see out there that you like and what do you see out there that you don't like?
Well, there's a lot of good architecture that's going on today. I mean, what is the au courant on the sort of advanced side are buildings that have what you might call big loops in them, big sorts of curves, this type of thing. That is the sort of the hot thing. For instance, here in Virginia, they just opened down at the VCU, the Museum of Contemporary Art, by a very eminent architect, Stephen Hull. And that's a sort of a hot type of thing. At the same time, some of the things I don't care about too much, it does seem to me that some of the American cities are being so overtaken with these tall glass buildings that are just becoming, oh my goodness. But also there is a real problem that when you go out into the American suburb, the new American suburb, a lot of the houses that are being designed out there could be a lot better if the firms, whether it is, okay, I won't name their names, but if they hired some people that knew how to do, if you want to do traditional architecture, do it right instead of just doing a mishmash of stuff and so forth. And part of that goes into the issue that architecture schools very frequently don't teach anything that is in the more traditional type of vein.
So speaking of curves, I was at the Guggenheim recently. Yeah. Have you seen the modern exhibit exhibit that's there now? It's Hilda Ott-Klint.
Oh, yes. That is amazing. Yeah. Well, she's an amazing artist and, of course, really not known that much. And she was doing this stuff a little bit before Kandinsky and Modrian, so forth. And then the other interesting thing is that she was part of the spiritualist movement back then. And this is a thing that sometimes is really left out of art history, is that these people, such as Kandinsky and Modrian, they were searching for something. They were trying to find something that was there. And very important in understanding their art.
Yeah, it was fascinating because she did predate some of those abstract expressionists and artists. And she said that she thought the world was not ready for her art, so she instructed not to release it until 20 years after her death. And there are these amazing, some of them are huge pieces, you know, works. And definitely the spirituality comes in, which is a great segue when we do segue to Jim Tucker. Because she really felt like she was guided. What do you think about that?
Well, as I said a minute ago, this element is something that's very, very important in actually 19th century intellectual thought here in the West. Emanuel Swedenborg, who had this idea of different levels of being. I mean, he was a Christian, but different levels of being and so forth. He was one of Emerson's representative men. You couldn't understand American transcendentalism. Emerson, Whitman, Thoreau, without recognizing that they are seeing that there is something more out there than just the absolute physical that is in front of us. And this is something that, let's say, permeates a lot of intellectual thought in the 19th and the early 20th century, and then it has sort of disappeared to some degree.
Mm-hmm. When you're curating an exhibit, how difficult, or is it difficult for you to let the artist speak to the space, or do you know, versus you being an architect, how do you balance all of that when you curate an exhibit?
Well, I mean, you try to understand. Most of my exhibits are more historical than contemporary, though I've done a couple of small exhibits here in town for a couple of the art galleries and so forth. But you try to understand what the art is and then to try to put it into the exhibit in some sort of way. I mean, Louis Comfort Tiffany is part of a huge Tiffany show, and Tiffany is very much a part of this spiritualist type of thing. You can't understand Tiffany's art, really, the glass and so forth, without understanding that there is something that is a little bit deeper that's behind it, and it is to try to let the art speak.
Could tell us about diners. I know you have a little expertise or interest in them. Could you tell us what you know? Not everything you know, of course, unfortunately, but...
Well, diners are sort of a disappearing element in the American landscape, though there is a big movement to preserve them. Just yesterday, a diner from Connecticut is being taken out to Indiana, I saw, to be preserved and to be used. But, of course, that was they predate the fast food, the McDonald's, Arby's, and something like that. They predate sort of a type of place of eating. They begin back in the 1920s. There were a couple of companies, initially of all places in Worcester, Massachusetts, and then went on to other places down in New Jersey that produced these diners that wound up pretty much across the country and so forth. But then, you know, the way that people, way we live today, we want to even go faster, you know. And so we just drive through and grab that hamburger and on you go.
And you mentioned McDonald's.
Yes. Yeah, but McDonald's, I mean, McDonald's is very, very important. Actually, one of the places I grew up in California is where the McDonald brothers started off before they were purchased and really went nationwide. But I've gone and visited both the McDonald's Museum in San Bernardino, California, and then the very first of what we think of the Golden Arch McDonald's is in Downey, California, and is a national landmark now.
This is when we all admit that we have seen them because we're old enough to have seen those and dined in those. The idea that the same person that is aware of McDonald's design, how did you become the director of the Victorian Society in America, and what's going on there this summer? Because I know you're directing it.
Well, I direct a summer school. That's what I do in Newport, Rhode Island, and then I also help out in the summer school in Chicago, and then we do have one in London. Well, it's just a way of trying to get people to come to different places to see some wonderful architecture in depth, not to just run through in, you know, the fast 20 minutes or whatever it is that you do going into a house, but to understand and to understand the depth of the stuff that is in the different cities. Newport, Rhode Island has arguably more great architecture per square foot than any other place in the country.
What kind of people show up at this summer school, Richard?
All sorts. All sorts. You just have to be a nut, that's all.
Well, it has just been delightful, as usual, talking with you, and so informative. You're invited back anytime when you're not traveling to these marvelous cities. Thank you so much. Richard Guy Wilson, the Commonwealth Professor of Architectural History at the University of Virginia.
Thank you.
Richard, wait 1 second. What are you working on? Anything that we need to know about? Is something coming up?
I am. The two projects that are on the plate right now. There's a book I'm doing on Monticello, of all things, but Monticello from an architectural point of view, and then updating. I did a big book on Virginia architecture for the Society of Architectural Historians. It was published back in 2001, and, of course, it's a little out of date, and so we're updating that, and that will go online hopefully in another year or something like that.
Cool.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks. I agree.
So, Nancy, do you have a news of note for us?
I do. It is not from the Victorian period because it's news of note. I guess it could be from them, but it's not. Anyway, yes, I do. Back to what we were discussing earlier, 15 House Republicans with an A NRA rating lost on Tuesday, and all 15 were replaced by Democrats with an F NRA rating, which always prompts that, you know, a rhetorical question, but I'm putting it in. How can owning a gun be a God-given right if you need the financial support of the NRA? Just saying. And then the other news of note is related. Democrats say that their first bill after taking power in January will be to establish automatic voter registration and reinvigorate the Voting Rights Act because
we
Georgia
need it.
is a crime. And yeah. Anyway, so you will not need your grocery ID when you go vote anymore once the Democrats take care of this.
That is really good news. Thank you for that. It reminds me of Stacey Abrams, who I believe she came out. I don't know if she conceded yet, but she said, you know, there's no doubt he's going to win, but she's about to sue and create a coalition to combat this just injustice.
Correct. I mean, what I've heard is that, you know, she's not going to use the word concede because of the whole way it was the election he ran it, but she knows the numbers, you know, she's accepting the results, I guess, not to speak for her, but she's just not using that word, you know, based on how the election went. I mean, that 0.2% is what's keeping this thing from being, you know, a runoff. It's just and I mean, 1.5 million people that were never allowed to vote, and the 35,000 or 50,000 he's gotten it, you know, he's not even saying voters that tried to register that he wouldn't accept this year alone, you know, it's aggravating.
Right. Okay. They can't win fairly. And then even when they cheat, we have done quite a lot of winning. So speaking of winning, we are very happy to have here Jim Tucker. He is the Bonner Lowry Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences and Director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He has published widely on the topic of children's past lives. His recent books are Life Before Life and Return to Life, both about the research on children's memories of previous lives. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so over the past 50 years, I really want to emphasize that because I don't think this is very little known. This is a little known area of research. But over the past 50 years, University of Virginia researchers have studied 2,500 cases from around the world of children's recollections of previous lives. So can you tell us some of these amazing stories, some of the strongest cases that you've encountered?
Well, sure. And like you say, it's been going on for 50 years, and there are a lot of cases. I haven't personally been doing it for 50 years, but it started with Ian Stevenson, who was the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry a long time ago. But one of the cases that I investigated that I thought was quite interesting was one day we got a letter from a mother in Oklahoma who said that she and her husband were just ordinary folks. She worked in the county clerk's office. Her husband was a police officer. But their little five-year-old, Ryan, for the past year, had talked about how he had a life in Hollywood, and he would cry and beg his mother to take him back to Hollywood for him to see his family there. To try to help him deal with this material, his mother went one day to the public library and checked out a couple of books on Hollywood. And they were looking through one when they came to a picture from an old movie called Night After Night. And Ryan pointed to one of the fellows in the picture and said, "Hey, Mama, that's George. We did a picture together." And then he pointed to another one and said, "And Mama, that's me. I found me." Well, the first person he pointed to is George Raft, who was a well-known actor back in the day. But the one that he said he had been was an extra with no lines in the movie. So Ryan's mom wrote to me to see if I could help figure out who this fellow was. So I went out to Oklahoma, and I met with Ryan's family, talked with him. And then after I came back, as we were trying to solve the mystery, Ryan's mother was emailing me sometimes on a daily basis with all these things that Ryan was saying about the past life. And to be honest, I thought it was unlikely that an extra with no lines in a movie would have the kind of life he was describing. But eventually, we were able to figure out who this guy was with the help of a Hollywood archivist. She went to the library of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, got all the materials about this movie Night After Night, and it included one picture where this guy was identified. It was a fellow named Marty Martin who had died in 1964. And it turned out that his life eerily matched the details that Ryan had given. Ryan said how he danced on stage in New York and Marty Martin danced on Broadway. He said he then went to Hollywood and worked in the movies, which Martin did mostly in dancing in the movies. He said he then worked for an agency and Marty Martin started a successful talent agency. He said he had a big house with a swimming pool, and the street address had the word Rock or Mount in it, and Marty Martin's big house with a swimming pool was on North Roxbury. And Ryan even was correct when he said that he had died when he was 61, despite the fact that Marty Martin's death certificate said he was only 59. We looked into it and have very clear evidence that, in fact, he was 61 when he died. And overall, over 50 of Ryan's statements matched to Marty Martin's life. So that's an example of the kind of cases that we like to study. And it's typical in the sense that a child can talk about a lot of details from a past life with great emotion. And then, as is often the case, people have been able to identify a person whose life matches the details that the child gave.
Wow, it's fascinating. We're talking with Jim Tucker. We're going to go to a break right now, and we'll be back to discuss more with Jim Tucker, the researcher of all of these fascinating stories. He's published widely on this topic of life after death. He's a board-certified child psychiatrist. We will be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We're here with Jim Tucker, the Bon Lowry Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences and Director of the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. So the question is...
Okay.
Do you want to go?
No.
Okay. The question is, how do you explain this? Because I know there are many more fascinating stories which we can read about in your books. But how do you explain this?
Well, of course, that's kind of the big question. For some of the cases, you can come up with fairly ordinary explanations. Perhaps the child overheard something or made lucky guesses, coincidence. But then you take a case like Ryan's, and those explanations don't really hold. And I think if you look at our strongest cases as a group, they do provide evidence that some young children have information about a life from the past. And the simplest way to explain that would be the idea of reincarnation, but it may well be more complicated than that. I mean, even if you accept these cases that they are valid, it wouldn't automatically confirm reincarnation, but there's some sort of paranormal or parapsychological connection that these children have to this past life.
When you're hearing stories like, or incidents, whatever they're technically called, from children, is what you describe, is everything so detailed, or, I don't want to fill up the air with a million questions, but I'm wondering, is there anything that's common, or what is the range, if it's not?
Yeah, and there is quite a range. I mean, not every child makes 50 statements by any means. There are some children who just have a very few kind of fleeting memories, often of how the previous person died. So in our cases, in over 70% of them, the previous person died by some sort of violent means, accident, murder, combat, suicide, that sort of thing. So that certainly seems to be an important factor in these cases. And it may well be that either dying violently or dying young, even the ones who died natural deaths, typically die young, although Ryan's case was an exception. But it may be something about the way that the previous life ends that sort of short-circuits the process so that the memories are then carried over to another life. Again, if you're accepting of these cases, that, you know, clearly the usual process is that children don't remember a past life. And it may well be that the rest of us have never had a past life, but it's also certainly possible that we do have multiple lives, but that the usual normal process is simply not to have any carryover of the memories.
I mean, I always have thought that children are so much closer to some other realm, you know, and they've just been born, and then over time, I think as adults, this is just my belief, over time we kind of lose that, you know, where it's kind of like when you're dreaming, you're very connected to your dream and then you just forget it, you know.
Well, exactly. That, you know, as we develop, we become sort of more grounded in this concrete reality. And you're right. I mean, young children, they have a lot of imagination and fantasy, and also at times can be very spiritual and do seem connected to something bigger. And you can well imagine from an evolutionary standpoint, we need to be grounded in this concrete reality in order to survive and not get, you know, the old days, get eaten by a large animal or whatever. So there are reasons why we would sort of let much of this go and then get fully wrapped up in this life.
As far as all of the cases you've studied, have you found anything trigger such a memory, or do you just get calls or emails, or, you know, correspondence from parents telling you this happened to my child?
Most of the time it seems to happen spontaneously. Now, there are times where a child will visit a place or something will happen that will seem to stir up the memory, and the child will say, oh, I had one of those in my last life or something like that. But for the most part, it's basically, once the children get where they can really talk well, I mean, the average age when the child starts talking about a past life is 35 months. So it's usually your 2 or 3 year old who starts coming out with these things, typically just spontaneously, randomly, that they start telling their parents these stories.
Was there ever a point where you weren't convinced about this? And if so, what changed your mind? And are you still surprised?
Well, yes. I mean, we certainly approach every case as it being an open question, what the best explanation is. So I certainly hope that I always maintain sort of an objective scientific perspective. I mean, we're not here to prove any sort of religious doctrine. I certainly did not grow up with any thinking about reincarnation whatsoever, really, even as an adult. I mean, it's more the question of life after death and exploring that and seeing, is there evidence that supports it? So I wouldn't say I went from being a non-believer to a total believer. I hope that I've more or less had the same attitude the whole way out. Now, I will say, as I've been in this work, I've become more persuaded that there's certainly a body of evidence here that requires explanation, and we're continuing to add to that body of evidence.
And what does the research look like? How do you analyze this sort of phenomenon? You know, what does your book, anyway, so what does your research look like? Sorry, Jim.
Well, there are different aspects to it. So we certainly try to study each case as closely as possible. So we document all the statements that the child has made, any behaviors that seem connected. So, for instance, in the violent death cases, over 35% of the children will have a phobia toward the mode of death. We collect all the information. We code it on 200 variables and put that information into a database, and then we can analyze various features of it. So it's both sort of field work as well as analysis.
And in your studies, what I'm sure, I can't imagine you don't also encounter every kind of parent. So what kind of advice you give these parents once they contact you?
Well, you're right. I mean, parents write us with sort of different questions. Some of them are concerned about their children. Most of them did not believe, most of the parents did not believe in reincarnation before their children started talking about these things. But we certainly, as far as advice to them, we encourage them to be open to what their children are saying, but not to become too focused on it and asking the child a bunch of questions, because one, that can be upsetting to the child, but also it can perhaps lead the child to start making things up. But just to sort of have a gentle openness to it, it can be helpful for some of the parents to know that this typically fades by the time the children are 6 or 7. So even like in Ryan's case, where he was crying every day to be taken to his previous place, by the time he got to be 7 or 8 anyway, this had largely faded away. And he's now a young teenager and doing very well and not talking about a past life anymore.
Yeah. Do you have yet any explanations for why the memories that are can be so detailed at some point, fade away?
Well, we're going to explore that a little more. Actually, we're preparing to do a study where we go back and interview adults who we originally studied when they were children, because even though almost all the children stopped talking about the past life, some of them, it seems, still hold on to the memories. They just don't tell anyone about them. And even in places in India or other places in Asia where there's a belief in reincarnation, it's still considered rather odd for a child to talk about past life. So there's sort of social pressure to stop regardless. But in many of them, the memories do seem to disappear. And it's typically at the same age that all children lose their memories of early childhood. So even though a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old has plenty of things in their long-term memory, by the time they're 8 or 9, most of those things have faded away. And it seems that this is kind of part of that process. And of course, there are tremendous changes going on in the brain during that age. Often those things fade, and it's probably best for the child, really, that those memories can fade and they can just focus on the current life.
I'm curious, can you tell us one more strong case that you encountered?
Sure. There's one case that got a fair amount of publicity, and in fact, the parents eventually wrote a book about their experiences, but it's a little boy named James Leininger who is thought to be thought to have memories of a World War II pilot, and around the time of his second birthday, he started having horrific nightmares multiple times a week of kicking his legs up in the air and screaming, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And during the day, he would take his toy airplanes and repeatedly say, airplane crash on fire, and slam them nose first into the family's coffee table, producing, I mean, I've got the picture, producing dozens of scratches and dents. So he was acting like a traumatized child, but hadn't been traumatized as far as anyone knew in this life. But eventually talked about how he had been an American pilot who had flown off of a boat and had been shot down by the Japanese. When his parents asked him the name of the boat, he said Natoma, and then said that he had been killed at Iwo Jima. Well, it turned out that there was this ship called the USS Natoma Bay that was involved in the Iwo Jima operation. And it lost one pilot in that operation. It was a young man named James Houston. And what we discovered was that James's statements, James Leininger's statements, eerily matched with Houston's death. In particular, he said how his plane had been shot in the engine, it had crashed in the water, and he had quickly sank. And that's exactly what happened to Houston. The other thing that James said one time was that his friend Jack Larson was there, and it turned out that Jack Larson was the name of the pilot of the plane next to Houston's on the day that he was killed. And again, this was 50 years back in the past as a World War II pilot, and it seemed inconceivable that little James had learned about this through any sort of ordinary means. So this is another case where, frankly, I have trouble even coming up with an ordinary explanation for how this little two-year-old, two- and three-year-old, came up with specific details about a pilot who was killed at Iwo Jima.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, do the hairs on the back of your neck ever not stand on end? I know we're running out of time. I was just wondering, what, or if you need to, do you respond to critics? What do you, how do you deal with skeptics, I guess, is, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, most skeptics don't pay a whole lot of attention to this work and just sort of discount it out of hand. I think if you look at the details of cases like the ones I've told you about, which of course are some of the stronger ones, it's hard, frankly, for skeptics to get into the weeds with these because they become impossible to explain away.
Yeah, so we have run out of time. We're going to need to run, unfortunately. But I just wanted to mention the quote on your website, jimbtucker.com, from Voltaire, which said, "It is not more surprising to be born twice than once. Everything in nature is resurrection." Thank you so much for being here.
Well, we're going to probably do this show again.
Yeah, we probably will do
all of us.
We'll definitely rerun it because it's one of my favorites. Thank you both, Richard Guy Wilson, Jim B. Tucker. Jim's books are Life Before Life, A Scientific Investigation of Children's Memories of Previous Lives, and Return to Life, Extraordinary Cases of Children Who Remember Past Lives. Thanks for being here. Our music is by Springtide. Thank you, Nancy Lawrence, my co-host and good friend. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to still do something, even though we won the house. Thanks, everyone. This is palate cleanser music. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.
Support today is coming from Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of contemporary American fine dining on Charlottesville's historic downtown mall. At Hamilton's, you'll find inspired seafood, steaks, and vegetarian fare with a full bar and eclectic wine list and always attentive service. Hamilton's supports sustainability in food production, transportation, and preparation, and in the community at large. You can see the lunch and dinner menus, make a reservation, or book the private dining space for your function all at hamiltonsrestaurant.com. That's hamiltonsrestaurant.com.
Hi, I'm Ellen. Carolyn Daniels inviting you to join me with my co-host Nancy Lawrence every Saturday morning from 10 to 11 on 94.7 for Apropos of Something. We talk to experts, activists, and the most interesting people we can find and guarantee that every show will be apropos of something. So join us this Saturday morning from 10 to 11 on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, for Apropos of Something, brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And don't forget, check out 947 WPVC.org for all our past shows.